Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Almost Famous, the podcast where I meet other people with famous family members and discuss how that has affected their journeys through life. My guest today is Elliot Steele.
You can't go on something and be shit and go, well, my dad's funny.
Elliot is a stand-up comedian who has appeared on Comedy Central shows Live from the Comedy Store and Roast Battle, as well as BBC Radio 1's Comedy Lounge.
What about that time you never came, you know, the Year 5 Christmas production to watch me play a sheep? Fuck you, Dad.
Elliot was nominated for Best Debut at the Dave Lester Comedy Festival and has written and performed 3 successful shows at the Edinburgh Fringe. Elliot's father is comedian, broadcaster, newspaper columnist and author Mark Steele.
My dad will go up there and do an amazing bit about Brexit and be able to rationalise it and be so knowledgeable about it. I can't.
Mark presented the Mark Steele Lectures on BBC Two and has appeared on shows including Red Dwarf, QI, Have I Got News For You, Mock the Week, Nevermind the Buzzcocks and Question Time.
My dad is a lefty liberal whose first point of call to take the piss out of is lefty liberals.
Mark also had 4 series of his own on BBC Radio 4, including the award-winning Mark Steele's In Town. He has also written several critically acclaimed books and contributed regular newspaper columns for The Guardian and The Independent. Recently, Mark appeared on Comedy Central's Roast Battle up against his son and our guest today, the aforementioned Elliot Steele. Elliot, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. I was just my mum was like 2 sentences and my dad's was like a whole paragraph, which is really sort of hammers home the point of this show, don't
well,
it?
Well, now is the right time for you to beef up that intro if you think, did I miss anything out?
You forgot of several of the uni nights I've played at where I've done 15 minutes of material.
And do you think your dad would be happy with that, you know, slightly depthy intro?
Yeah, I imagine he would be. There's probably a couple of things. He'd probably want you to mention several other things that he's done because that's what he's like. And he'd be mm-hmm. like, oh, and I did this and I did that. And then, if you could mention that I beat him in a roast battle, that would be...
Well, actually, to be honest, my first question is, it's quite an interesting thing going up against your dad on Roast Battle. For anyone listening who has never seen Roast Battle on Comedy Central, basically, 2 people go up against each other and try and, you know, say the most mean, cruel things as they possibly can. And they tend to try and get people who are either... I'd say the best ones are like you and your dad or Harriet Kemsley and Bobby Mair, who are married, went up against each other. And I know Lou Sanders and Luke McQueen, who are flatmates, are doing it up against each other. So what was that like?
It was fun. It was kind of weird because me and my dad, we had to make this agreement beforehand of like anything. I've done quite a few like roast battles as well with like good mates, and you always sort of have like a thing of going like, hey, is there anything you don't want me to bring up? And if they're not a pussy, they'll be like, no, anything's cool. So we.
So you agreed. Anything goes.
Anything goes, really, and then that was it from there. But it was just a lot of fun. It wasn't like because the thing with a roast battle is there's a lot of love in it. It's not just like going up there and going, yeah, well, you suck. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. If I went up there and was like, what about that time you never came, you know, the Year 5 Christmas production to watch me play a sheep? Fuck you, Dad. Like he wouldn't have. That isn't it. But then I went out there and pretended he molested me as a child.
Oh, yeah.
Which was...
No, that's fine. That one's fine.
Which is fine. but that is odd, because that's like kind of the relationship. It was like, we have a good relationship as father and son, and then now his relationship is comedians, it's fine. So the father and son element is something we're going to play on, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So I watched a bit of it, and... you as well as having seen a fair bit of your stand-up, and you talk a lot on stage about growing up around the estates of South London.
Yes, but not being from one.
Yes, okay, yeah, fair enough. And yet, your dad hilariously on Roast Battle described you as having grown up in a semi-detached house next to a yachting lake. So, A, how very, very brilliant of your dad, but B, like, how much truth, you know, so no truth, you never lived in a South London estate, just around them.
So what happens, to let people know what happens when you come into, so I came into show business when I was 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you come into show business at 16 years old and you get picked up quite quickly is someone goes, here's your USP. This is it. And because I was new to the comedy industry, I didn't have like the ability to go, that's not true. That's nothing like that. I didn't, okay. Because
right.
I was just very new to it.
And when, just sorry to interrupt, but when you say picked up quickly, do you mean by an agent and they're giving you advice? Or
yeah, not necessarily an agent, but like PR agents, people who were trying to push you in a certain direction, producers. Like I had a producer the other week messaged me about being like, going like, oh, we need you to sort of do this thing for us and really sort of working class it up. And I went, I'm not working class, I'm middle class.
Mm.
And they went, no, we need the kind of person who's grown up eating tinned food.
Right.
And I was like, what do you think working class
people... You need
people...
someone from the war.
Yeah, yeah. What, get a cat. So that's kind of what it is. And what happened is... I sort of at that time just went, yeah, sure, that could be my bio. And in years on, I've looked back and gone, uh-oh, I haven't updated my bio, but now I know.
Right.
And especially when I'm on stage and I'm talking about, like, I'm not. I just grew up in Croydon. Like, I have this accent. People assume I'm working class. I lived opposite a council estate in a lovely semi-detached house. This accent is a survival tactic, not a regional twang.
That's that's really interesting, actually, because I grew up in Surrey, but not in Croydon.
Right, okay.
But I went to the Metropole in Croydon one night, and I was scared. That was an old club, back, way too young for you. But actually, I was going to ask, so you started when you were 16, but how old are you now?
23.
Okay, so you're like you're a veteran of the stand-up scene.
I wouldn't say, I think veteran, you've got to have done 20-plus years to be a veteran.
Yeah.
I think I'm sort of a recruit. I was sort of a promising recruit who's been promoted and demoted back to recruit. His dad was in the army, so he got made a corporal and then put him back to a recruit.
But most importantly, you're sticking at it, which is, you know, I believe I heard at some point that the dropout rate of stand-ups in their kind of first 5 years is something like 90%, something huge like that. So the key is just to stick at it.
Yeah, unless you're really bad at it, then I do think there are some people you watch. Like, if you watch someone new and they're bad, I always think if people are new and bad at something, like, oh, give them time, you know, they'll learn. It's hard work. If you've been going for 5+ years and you're still terrible, you don't need this, man. There'll be something else you can do.
But nobody really tells you, do they? I mean, nobody would tell some of those people, do you think? Do you think they'd say it to their face?
I think would the you? Audience...
oh, the audiences do, sure.
Would I tell someone to quit? It depends on their... It depends. Like, you can always tell someone, like, there's always a thing of, like, just being a comic. Sorry to just make this podcast already just all about comedy.
No, it's all good.
But it's kind of... You can tell when people... there's a story I got of there's a comic, Nick Cody, and me and my friends, what we do in stand-up is we watch terrible stand-ups on YouTube, like open micers and stuff, and not just open micers, but like people's terrible stand-ups, including some of our own first clips.
Mm-hmm.
And we were watching this one guy, and Nick said something that was so right, because this guy could edit the video. He clearly edited all, but he was terrible at stand-up, and Nick went, dude, this guy needs to... You can do something else.
Mm-hmm.
You've got something else. And it's like, yeah, none of us have... any other transferable... Like, if tomorrow everyone went, we're done with comedy, no one wants to go to that anymore, there's nothing else I can do.
Right.
Like, I haven't got a skill.
Right.
I didn't pay attention in school.
Yeah.
I was trying to show off and get laughs.
Yeah.
So I've not got anything else. So if that happens, then it is literally, I'm probably just going to end up on the streets.
Yeah. And what you said about the audience tell people, which is true, but I also find that people like the kind of open micers and people you talk about who... don't really improve. They have an element of self-delusion where I feel like they probably think that the audience are laughing a lot more than they are, or they take from a gig what they want rather than what the truth is a little bit. Whereas I think the majority of stand-ups will always, who are good, let's say, will always pinpoint maybe the one or two people in the audience who weren't laughing and take that away rather than... It feels like an opposite level of delusion almost.
I always think the odd thing with stand-up is that I just think it requires like a level of self-awareness. And I think a lot of people in this job don't have it,
yeah.
Even at quite a high level.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't go away, but it just sort of weeds people out. So like with me, like I've always had the self-awareness that my dad is who he is. He's a very respected comedian and I'm coming in as someone's son.
Mm-hmm.
So I am going to get a leg up in certain things when I first started. I'm going to be able to know how bits of the industry work and stuff. But then you've still got to prove yourself. You can't go on something and be shit and go, well, my dad's funny.
No.
And then they'll just be like, get your dad on.
No, well, I think that point sums up exactly why I'm interested in talking to people who are related to people who are successful in a similar field.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people don't want to talk about it. A lot of people don't want to admit it. Whereas to hear you so kind of freely admit, or not admit, but openly be self-aware enough to know that there are elements that will have helped you get higher up at an earlier time.
Oh, good.
Is really honest, I think, and open.
Me and my dad, we're with the same agency. Mm-hmm. Now, I got it with that agency because they like my stuff. They saw me because my dad, the way I got into comedy, right, was there's a club called Old Rope.
Mm-hmm.
Really good new material night. My dad knew Tiff, the lovely Tiff Stevenson, who I sort of everything to. He knew her. She's a fan of my dad. She loved my dad. She found out I wanted to do comedy. She went, come just try it one night there. I did it there. Mike Wilmot was there. Mm-hmm. He saw me. He told Danny off the curb, whose name I probably shouldn't use, but he told this guy, Danny, who I also owe my career to, off the curb. Danny just emailed my dad and went, hey, does Elliot want to come do a spot down at my club one time? My second gig, I did that, and Danny picked me up. That's how I got into comedy.
Wow.
But I could have, that's a complete leg up. Mm. Like, it would be ridiculous of me to sit here and go, no, I grafted and did the miles when I first started. I didn't.
Mm.
But I still had to do all right at those gigs.
Yeah, if you were shit, they wouldn't have picked you up.
Oh, yeah.
Which is something that people forget probably when they're slightly enviously, and probably, I dare say, not to your face, but if anyone were to say, oh, well, he's only there because his dad is, that's bitter jealousy and envy. You still have to be good to be able to do it.
But there's different kinds of legs up in this game. Like, there'll be people who will go, you know what I mean? Everyone's going to get a chance at some point.
Mm-hmm.
This is the thing with comedy. There's never a point, like, there's times where I have fucked up because of my arrogance. That way I came into comedy, it came detrimental years later.
Okay.
Because I believed my own hype.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't put the work in.
How did that manifest itself?
I was just going out and partying a lot, and I was sort of doing a fringe one year. And the show it was an all right show. The worst kind of show you can have is average, because it doesn't make you go, that'll do. Rather than like, this is bad, I need to work on it.
Right.
And whereas like this year, I had the best show I've ever written. And it's a good thing I had that average show because it taught me how to work properly.
Mm-hmm.
But I just sort of fucked about and stuff because I believed my own hype, which if I'd probably had to graft at the beginning, I wouldn't have done.
Yeah.
So it can be detrimental. It can come back on you, I find, that way of, because I came in and was like, yeah, comedy's easy, this. I'll just do, and I was too young as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think I started way too young. Because you have to become an adult very quickly, which I didn't do, still haven't done.
No,
like and because comedy can, you have to become an adult quickly. By what I mean, and like learn to go home after a gig,
right?
Do your set.
I think there are people a lot older, you know, there are proper adults who are still not going home after gigs.
No, exactly. But you see them, and do you know what? They're the biggest wake up calls because if you see someone not on the circuit. Like, if you're doing, like, a weekends at, like the big comedy clubs and stuff, people stay around and have a drink. Going out then, that person's a professional comedian. They do this as a job. But there's some absolute states of people you see who've been on the circuit for, like, 25-plus years.
Mm.
They're nice guys. They haven't changed their set. They haven't done anything. And they just sat there depressed after a gig, drinking a beer, trying to, hey, girls, I was just on stage.
Yeah.
And you go, and that's when I go, like, how do you not become that?
Right.
How do you stop that coming through your life? And then you look, and then you'll go, oh, it's easy for, like, such and such. You know, he just came famous, and that was that done. And you're like, all right, how did he, well, he went to Edinburgh, he kept writing, and then, you know, anyone's fame, you can, you know, people love it in this game to go, like, oh, someone like Michael McIntyre.
Mm.
All right, it's easy for him, he just goes out and notices things. No, he doesn't. He gets up every day at 6 and writes, and he goes out and he works hard, and he does everything you have to do to get to that level and then stay at it and be on top of the game. But you can boil success down to. Oh, well, it was easy for him. He just got signed up to a big agent. He put him on TV and that was that. And you're like, yeah. No.
Do you know, well, what's interesting about you bringing up Mike McIntyre, and I think I brought him up in a previous episode as well, is that he is an example of someone who, and I completely agree with you, absolute workhorse, deserves all the success he gets, but also is just a genius observer of things. But, so he's one of the very rare people who gets crossover success. So he's gone over to primetime as well in terms of television stuff. But he's got his peers, a lot of his peers, Stuart Lee, for instance, giving him shit for being mainstream and, you know, selling out or whatever. And I'm just like, even at that top level where people get really successful, it can still breed envy. And I find that really odd.
It is odd. Don't get me wrong. I'm a big fan of both. Like, I'm a fan of stand-up comedy. Hmm. I'm not... My favourite comedian will be Doug Stanhope, but I also will enjoy watching Michael McIntyre because I enjoy stand-up comedy. I enjoy different perspectives and things. Like, at the moment, I'm a big fan of Dave Chappelle. I love what Dave Chappelle does.
Yeah.
But then I'll also go and watch, like, Whitney Cummings. So I find, like, in stand-up, when you get to someone like Stuart Lee, who I'm, again, huge, huge, huge fan of, the Princess Diana routine on his special at the Glasgow Stand is one of the best routines, one of my favourite routines of all times. I'm a huge fan of him. However, I don't understand why he's seen as, like, this, like, underdog. Like, he's, like, the go-to. He's mainstream alternative. He's what people, he's first choice, I don't like the mainstream.
Yeah.
Like, if you really don't like the mainstream, you'd be a Jerry Sadowitz fan. It's just like a sort of pompous way of people go, and not Stuart Lee himself, but I find a lot of his fan base are like this thing of, I don't like McIntyre or somebody of that stature or Catherine Ryan or Ramesh, so I watch Stuart Lee. And you're like, who also had a primetime BBC Two television
and
show.
And has been on BBC Two since the late 90s as well. But I think the interesting, or the thing that gets me a bit about it is I just feel like there should be slightly more teamwork involved in that, you know, you're all ploughing the same furrow and you're all different types of artists and different flavours of comedians. But why then stab someone in the back who's trying to do the same thing? It strikes me as slightly, you know, you can only almost really do that when you've got to a point where you feel safe enough in the work that you're going to get where it's not going to affect you. And that, to me, is kind of contradictory.
Yeah, I find, okay, I find, I was speaking about this, funny enough, to my dad the other day, and he completely agreed. He was, the reason stand-up in this country, and I think, not just stand-up, but, like, we're behind Americans in terms of sitcom, in terms of, you watch a show like Always Sunny in Philadelphia, it takes so many risks. Sometimes it misses, but it doesn't matter because it lands the majority of the time. It's one of my favourite shows, and they just take risk after risk after risk. And that's because in America, they have, if you're a good young stand-up, you're put into a writer's room, you're made to work with people, and sure, it can be cutthroat, I'm sure it can be bitter, but over here, we don't do that. How do you get seen early on if your dad's not a comedian? You enter a comedy competition.
Yeah. Or do a course.
Mm-hmm. You've got to enter a comedy competition. So you're immediately pitted up against other stand-ups. There's an environment put into your psyche that you have to compete with these people. Then you have to go up to the Edinburgh Fringe. What are we doing at the Edinburgh Fringe? We're competing for audience members. We're competing for reviews. We're competing for the nomination on the award so we can turn around to our peers and go, ha ha, you see, I am worth something. So you then have to do that. So you're completely competing. Now you've got to go on a panel show. Okay, what do you do on a panel show? I've got to get my words put in. So you're competing. So we have this environment that makes us compete, that then when you're at the top of the game, of course you're going to turn around to people and be like, ha ha, fuck you, I got here, but you didn't get here the way I got here. I really had to struggle to get here. And we don't go, hey, you're good at this. All right, you're doing your gigs and stuff. Here's some money. So you can live a little bit. Sit down and work together. Sit down and try and do something with each other.
Yeah.
But we don't do that here. And then we wonder why we're all against each other.
It's actually really, it's really toxic to think about. And reminds me, we were talking about, so Elliot and I have played football together before. And we were talking about in the game that we played and Rob Beckett used to play in it. And when I started doing stand-up around the same time Rob did, so we're in the same kind of, like the Amuse Moose competition,
same class
the kind of same year, whatever. And I just remember one time, and I really like Rob, he's a great guy, and what he said was not in any way, I doubt, was actually in any way an opinion or abusive, but to me it really hurt me at the time. But I walked up to a gig and he was like sat with a group of comedians, and I said, oh, I'm Barnaby. He's like, I know you, yeah, you do the disgusting stuff, right? And yeah, when I was doing stand-up, I would tend to go into some darker territories, I think it's fair to say. But at the time, I really took that to mean like, oh, you think I'm really shit. But he wasn't saying that at all. And that's just my insecurity and where I was. But that was me already, I guess, feeling competitive. Do you know what I mean? And feeling like, oh, okay, I'm being judged by someone else. But the reality was actually different, I think, in that case, probably, in hindsight. But so many people with so many different egos and ambition and stuff like that. And I think the way you described it is true. It is a competition. I've certainly been in so many cars driving to and from gigs up north where you've got people slating other comedians who then you see them actively being lovely to their face. And I find that really difficult.
So. Yeah, it's. I think in something like comedy, what's really important, and I noticed this through my dad, is he had just a good group of friends who, like, from the age of about 23 to now he's 59. He'll
appreciate you having given out his age, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm 21, I started at 16, and you're 59.
Yeah, if anyone's listened to this, don't book him, he'll be dead soon.
We really better get this out before he dies.
Oh my God, imagine my dad died and then this podcast went out.
Well, I'd mostly
and then
be annoyed.
This clip goes round.
I'd mostly be annoyed because it'll take some proper editing to edit around that. But yeah, sorry, carry on.
It's his group of comedy friends. Mm. They all respected each other, worked with each other. You know, the late Jeremy Hardy, who died this year, with my dad, my best mate, my dad, Mark Lamar, my dad, Joe Brand, all these people. They all came up together. Mm. So there is a way, but the thing that was different back then was comedy was an underground thing. Comedy, there wasn't an industry. Like now, there's an industry. I'm on a podcast talking about being related to another comedian because people will listen to it. It's an industry. People will want to hear it. Back then, there was a guy called the Iceman. Have you heard of the Iceman?
No, I haven't. Tell me about the Iceman.
This guy's a legend, right? It was,
sounds like he should have been in Gladiators.
Yeah, like, but his act was he just used to take on a block of ice and then get a blowtorch out and just melt it. That would be on before you.
Yeah.
That would happen. And this guy, what we were talking about, people going around for years, that's just what he did.
That must have been at Malcolm Hardy's club, surely.
The Tunnel Club. I think he was on everywhere.
Yeah.
People just put him on because he just turned up with a block of ice. Yeah. Go on.
Because actually, I was going to ask, presumably, you know, having talked to your dad a lot about comedy and that stuff, is there an element where he, or where you have spoken so much that it's obvious that it's a lot harder for you to, or a lot harder for comedians now than it was for comics back then? Because of the scale and the amount of comedians around?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. I think back then it was easier in a sense to become a comedian. How am I going to word this?
As a professional or?
Yeah, but there wasn't really a professional thing. There wasn't like, but there wasn't a circuit. They made the circuit. People like Alexi Sale just before my dad, Rick Mayall, made comedy, because before that it was all, you know, two Jews walk into a, but that's what they were up against.
70s comedians.
Yeah, on the end of a pier. That's what was going on. So they then went and did their own thing, and then when people started coming to that, it came a thing, but it still wasn't. It was, but that was the kind of thing they were,
you know,
Bernard Manning.
Yeah.
Who, you ask my dad, me and my dad have talked about this. Wasn't a bad comedian for any sense of back in that term of day. If you watch his stuff, horrible person.
Yeah.
Like, clearly just not a nice bloke. Mm. But wasn't bad at that. He was the king of that thing, and they sort of looked at that and went, right, I don't want to do that. And now that's why when alternative comedians, like, well, what you see is alternative are, like, looking at the mainstream and going, like, we don't, you know, look at McIntyre, well, we don't want to do that, so we're going to walk on dressed as a giraffe and talk about being a giraffe for a day.
Yeah.
You're like, well, there was a point to being alternative back then because there was something to fight against. There was a fight against racism and the Thatcherism.
Yeah.
Whereas now you just, because McIntyre sells a lot of tickets, that's a silly fight.
Yeah, so my background a little bit was developing TV shows. I worked at the BBC in the kind of mid-noughties, developing entertainment TV shows. And at the time, it was very much like stand-up on TV doesn't work. So it was just before the Apollo came out.
Right.
It was very much like, look, stand-up on TV just won't work. People won't watch it. Stand-up is very much just for the clubs. It's never going to work out. And it takes risks and decisions for those things to change. So then Apollo came, and then people, you know, and then Mock the Week came, where they engineered a panel show out of stand-up, and things changed like that. And it will have taken your dad and his generation and Alexi's generation before to make those changes.
Yeah, definitely. And it's something that I think they I think they feel like they kind of looked over for a little bit.
Yeah.
Because you know, it exists because they did that. And
I think they feel like they don't get enough props.
Yeah, kind of. But then there's still guys on the circuit from their generation who I gig with now. And, like, they're also overlooked as, like, people, like, you'll sort of go, eyes and, you know, I did it just now. I've gone, oh, I ain't changed his set for years. And it's like, well, this guy, because he went up there and did that, made the circuit for someone like me and my mates to come onto.
Yeah.
But I find as into, regarding to your earlier question, it's harder now in terms of, that's why I'm in stand-up. I'm seen as working class because my dad's Mark Steele and I've got an accent.
Yeah.
I'm not working class.
Mm. But they pigeonhole you as such for their own benefit in a way.
Well, because what working class person can afford to do stand-up?
Right. Yeah.
You've got the Edinburgh Fringe is going to cost. Now, there's people up there who do it. They are dumb, but they get completely overlooked. You know, the Edinburgh Fringe is going to cost you minimum about 5,000 quid if you want to take a show up.
Yeah.
You're going to need some financial backing from parents. You're going to need time. Hey, can I take 3.5 weeks off work?
Yeah.
Which I've never had a proper job. I can do that. You know, because I was in a privileged position. So that's why I feel like when someone goes like working class, this, that, I feel like a bit of a fraud, to be honest, that there will be someone out there who's working class and just as good at what I do, who's not going to be given the opportunity. But you've got that in stand-up now, whereas before, when my dad was going on as a working class thing, there was like a real like stand-ups are working class. Alexi Sayle was working class. My dad is working class. Jeremy Hardy is working class. These people come on here and they're speaking for the working man. And whereas now, if you want to do that, it's kind of like, well, you know, you're going to have to get a PR. You're going to have to come and do this. You got to do the Edinburgh Fringe, and then to break onto the circuit to do gigs is expensive. You've got to travel back and forth to places for free. Sometimes you're going to spend your day, you know, things that are hard work that I wouldn't say, once you've made it, it's not hard work because that's what you have to do.
Sure.
You know, I'm sure you've done those nights at a bus station waiting for a National Express and then you get on and there's a load of nutters on it and you're questioning why you've just done that gig all the way in Leeds for 20 quid.
Shows how privileged you are not even to get the mega bus, mate. I was just wondering, just thinking about what you were saying, do you think there's an opportunity for comedians who have probably, you know, made money and success out of it to give something back to those people who don't get those opportunities? So I was just thinking, because obviously Stormzy, the musician, gives grants for people to go to Oxbridge for underprivileged black kids who would never usually get a chance to go to Oxbridge to be able to afford to go there. I wonder if there's an opportunity for, and I'm not naming any names, but people who are successful to give back in some way.
People do. I know of people
really?
Who do. I know of a few stories. I'm not going to, like...
that's really good.
But, you know, bait up the spot. Because there are people out there who do a lot of stuff. I know a few people who have just, you know... Like working class comedians from unprivileged backgrounds. I have a mate who's a very successful stand-up comedian, and he does things like that.
Brilliant.
He just sometimes goes, hey, look, I'll pay you rent for the Fringe. Look, I'll... It does happen.
That's good. What I love about that most is that I don't know about it, because he's so clearly not doing it for his own benefit.
Yeah. There will be people like out there who do that, and they don't ask for a thing. The thing is, it's like there's a thing called Comedians Benevolent Fund or something, which is about, and it's a good idea, but it's a charity that, like, who in the scheme of charities is going to give a fuck about stand-up comedians who, like, they're always like, we should get people to donate and stuff. And I'm like, I don't think the person walking down the street
yeah.
gives a fuck that
no.
someone
to put
that
in a
jonglers went bust. So some people aren't going to might have to get a day job. No one's going to give, so they can't live their life of waking up at 12 in the afternoon. some they're going to have to work an extra 20 hours. Like, no one's going to give a fuck about.
Sounds
that.
Attractive to me, but I can see your point. I'm yeah. not sure that many people will get it.
So like it, I don't want to slag it like because in comedy, like I don't want to slag it off, but like I want to take the piss out of it a bit. But you've got these things that exist and these people who do help other comedians out. But I think in terms of an industry, it's where the industry is set up in this country, and it's not like we need down with the industry and this that. Industry is actually pretty good. You mm-hmm. can make it. You know, you got online now. You look at the success of Mo Gilligan.
Yeah.
I know Mo a little bit, yeah. right? I remember I was at, me and Mo were hanging out one time before this gig we had to do together. I was like, hey, man, you're doing Edinburgh this year? He's like, nah, man. He was like, no, I can't afford that. Like, he's like, I can't, you know? And he was like, I got quoted these things. And I think he talked about it on the Quotes Fool podcast recently. And I was like, oh, okay. And then he later on was going, oh, yeah, because I do like, he was doing like angel comedy and stuff. He was just doing spots. And he's like people kept turning up because I'm on it, so I might just do my own thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, cool, do that, man.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, yeah, that'll be a good idea. And now everyone knows who Mo Gilligan is.
Yeah.
So there are ways in the industry you can sort of turn around to the industry yeah. and go, I'm not going to do it your way.
Not going to follow the usual path.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Which then is annoying because, like, the whole industry then goes to everyone else. Why don't you do it like Mo Gilligan and you have to go, like, because I'm not going to be... You can't replicate what he's just done because he paved the way for it.
I guess it just shows to follow your own path, really, and find your own ways. You've mentioned quite a bit about... been incredibly open about what it was like and what leg-ups you've had from being Mark's son, obviously. I'm interested to know whether you think you're a comedian because... Are you Mark's son, or almost like despite it? Was it something you fought against at any point, or was it just always the natural path?
I always knew from about when I was 8 years old I was going to get into stand-up. Like, that's why I never tried at school. Because
mm-hmm.
I have I don't want to blame it on this, but I have, like, really bad ADHD.
Okay.
And when I was just at school, I find school's this thing. The reason stand-up was attractive to me, script writing as well, like when I've done bits of script writing and things like that, the reason those things are attractive to me is because it encourages imagination, it encourages thinking outside of a box, it encourages... And I got to see my dad when I used to go see my dad's shows. It was like, oh, yeah, he thinks outside the box. He's great at this. Oh, yeah. And also my dad, like, my dad's seen as this hugely rallying political comedian. Does a little bit on politics, but most of it's about his life, or most of it's just about a subject that he finds interesting, and then there's a little bit of politics in there. He's just active in the political community, the left-wing sort of community. Mm-hmm.
But clearly stuff that's relatable to other people, be they, you know, in the entertainment industry or not, or just normal people. So, that side of him and how politics affects him obviously relates to them.
Yeah, exactly. And but he, like, when I used to go to shows and see that, I'd just be like, oh, that's cool. Oh, okay. Because this is the thing. I think the biggest, and I've always said this, the biggest leg up my dad ever gave me, not with agencies, not with gigs, not with anything like that, was I knew it was a viable career option, which I think a lot of people don't. And it is hard work. Like, even though I've had these legs up and stuff, I've had to work hard a lot of times. And, you know, that's what you got to do. And so there's a lot of self-doubt involved in it. Like, when I first started, I was kind of like, shit, should I change my name? Are people going to get... When I walk out to a rowdy drunk crowd on Friday night, no one is sat there going... Oh, is that Mark Steele's son? And even if they do, they usually are, oh, that's cool. Oh, that's Mark's son. Okay, I've heard he does stand-up. And then they listen, they might like him or not, whatever. It doesn't really affect...
No.
No one's ever come to see me, I don't think, because I'm Mark's son.
No.
You have to make that happen yourself. But knowing that it's a viable career option is what helped me get through school, because I think there are probably a lot of people at school and stuff who are there. There's this system, and again, it's probably massively wrong, but I always see school as like, it's a measurement on obedience. How obedient can you be?
Mm.
Can you do the homework? Can you do this? It doesn't encourage creative thought.
Yeah.
Because creative thought, we live in this society where, you've got ADHD, you've got a mental health problem. No, I'm imaginative. I think this is the way I think, and it doesn't correlate with the way that I went to a really shit state school. So my dad, true to his socialist believings, didn't want to send me to private school. Mm-hmm. And didn't, and I'm kind of grateful for it, but I wasn't at the time because I took a lot of beatings.
Right.
But that's kind of what you have that makes you a comedian, is your outside of the box thinking. I've never had a problem with any of the kids at school, as far as like you get the odd like kicking and stuff, but that was school.
Rite of passage.
But that happens to everyone. And then I'll speak to my mate Tom Horton, who went to like the most poshest of posh schools. And they're brilliant.
You just get a better class of beating.
Yeah, because they've got money back in their bullying. Like they get
you're getting beat with gold bars.
Oh my god! Yeah, the stories he's told me, I'm like, man, this is you know, like when you watch like an American high school film, and like the bullying's always so like severe, and there's like they'll like involve like this massive prank, like the end of Carrie, like the level that you have to go to for that prank. You can't do that at a British state school. It's like, where are we going to get pig's blood from? We can't afford pig's blood.
We can't afford cellophane to even do the toilet cellophane gag.
Exactly. So it's just like, oh, we'll throw this textbook at him. It's one between two anyway. Like, who cares? But that's kind of the... But it was the teachers that I used to despise the most, because I think teachers are people who want to... A lot of them do want to help. There were some good ones, but I find most of them are people... who they get a power trip of what they do, and like, why do I have to call you sir? Why do I have to address you by your last name? Well, because you've got to come in here and learn about this. Why? When am I ever going to use this stuff? Why are you teaching me geography about places that I've not been to, or like, or sediment? Here's how rock works. This is a sedimentary, this is granite. And it's like, why aren't I learning how tax works? Why aren't I learning how a mortgage works? Why hasn't someone, I know, like, there's this, it's massively selfish to make it about the individual, but I'm a comedian, that's what I do.
Mm.
Why aren't some of you there? Well, I got thrown out of college, but I was allowed to do one course. They allowed me back to do one course, and that was media studies. Mm-hmm. I did it, and then 6 weeks after I was kicked out of college, I started stand-up comedy, and by the time my results came out, I'd been signed. And I went in, I got my results, and I got an E in media studies. Mm-hmm. But now I write scripts for like stolen, well, I was on the script writing thing with like stolen pictures, who like my comedy heroes were Simon Pegg and Nick Frost and stuff. So how can I go from getting an E in that to having the ability to do that? Well, that's something's wrong with that system.
Well, it's exactly what you said. The curriculum isn't set up to actually help in terms of real life practical things. I mean, I think in reality, if I can theorize about it, a lot of education is built to push you towards the next stage of education.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's for, in a lot of ways, it's for people to then, you know, move on to A levels, and then how good a university can you go to if you're going to go to university? That's the only reason for me why those things were being taught. I went to university, but I was similarly, I did go to private school,
right, yeah,
which was a complete waste of money because I had no interest in, intellectual education at all. I was interested in sport. And I was interested in girls, and that was pretty much it.
Which is as you should be.
Right, exactly.
that's the other thing with school. Like, the sex education class isn't anything... The sex education class, they should be teaching, like, consent. They should be teaching, like, hey, here's what consent is. This is how this works. Because now you have this group, no one knows what it is because we have this generation raised on porn. Hey, look, porn's not real. This is what they should be teaching people.
Hopefully they are a bit more now, you'd like to think.
I hope so, but they don't. But like, did you, when you said you were working in like TV and stuff, did you get that through university or did you could like start on a runner's job?
So I did badly my GCSEs and snuck through into sixth form at the same school basically because I was good at cricket and I think they let me through. And then I didn't get into the university I wanted to go to because I got C, D, E at A level, and one of those was in, and the C was in general studies,
right, okay,
which you had to take, and it was just basically ticking boxes. So I went through clearing, and I ended up going to the University of Greenwich. And the reason I went there, and it's barely even a university, is because my cousin was there as a sabbatical officer, sports sabbatical officer, so he ran the sports teams. But one of the main reasons he said I should come is because it's not a university that's hard to get into. They had really good football team who were in like Boosa One football. So I played a really good level of football and really enjoyed that and got to hang out with girls and learned. That was when I started drinking and learned how to basically have fun for the first time in my life. But getting into TV, interestingly, at Greenwich, I did media studies in essence. And the best thing about that was instead of just doing a 10,000 word dissertation, they let you make a film. And I made a film where I went on TV shows under a fake name. So I went on Ready, Steady, Cook as this character called Simon Sester, because I thought it sounded like Siren Sester. And I went on, like, I was in the audience on Trisha, and I went on some other things and did some radio stuff and made a documentary about this character, Simon Sester, who was addicted to going, addicted to the media and kind of, you know, cut in those little bits. And in the after leaving university, I sent that to a load of TV companies. And I ended up getting a screen test for Children's BBC, right? And went in. The screen test was a 10-minute version of a show they did on the CBBC channel called Exchange. It's like a magazine show, quite typical. You know, kids phone in to play games, interviews with celebrities, whatever. So I did an As Live 10 minutes with another presenter. And I remember coming away from that 10-minute As Live show, and I was like, I've found what I'm good at, finally.
Yeah.
Like, I found what I'm good at. I'm brilliant at this. They're going to offer me the job, right? 3 weeks later, I hadn't heard anything. kind of contacted them. They said, we're not going to give you the job as a presenter, but we thought your film was really brilliant. Would you like to come and work as a runner? And that's how I got my job. And then the first thing I did when I went in as a runner, they said, do you want to see your screen test? And I was like, yeah. And I watched it back, and I was fucking awful. Like, honestly, like, awful. And I was trying to be a children's TV presenter. But I wasn't myself, and there was only one bit in it. I remember when I finished it, I was like I said, I was like, oh, I'm brilliant. I found what I'm good at. But if I don't get this job, it'll be because of that bit where the kid phoned in and I took the piss out of the kid a bit.
Yeah.
Like, just gently ribbed him a bit. And I watched it back and I was like, the only good bit was the bit where you took the piss out of the kid, because that's who you are. You're kind of a bit sarcastic, bit on the edge, and the kid enjoyed it.
That's amazing to learn.
I needed
that
to be
on,
more myself.
Yeah, that's the thing in stand-up I've only learned in the last couple of years, is like, go on and be really who you are. So like now, that's why when I go on a thing, and like, so my thing now is to take my thing that's like South London Council, say, go on there and just talk about how like the industry made you try to be that. Like, that's the interesting thing.
Yeah.
Don't go on there and, you know, go on there and do those sort of things. But
and the beatings at school, I'd like to hear more about on stage if possible, Elliot.
I was just mouthy, but not very fast.
Yeah.
But that's how it is. Like, most people I've met in this industry who have got somewhere, they haven't come in through, like education sort of got you to where you needed to be, but the...
By my own decision, to be honest, making that film, yeah.
But the runner's job there, like, the amount of people I meet who are a producer, how'd you end up producing? Did you go uni? Nah, just my mate Mike worked here, and then he was like, we got a running job going, and then I did that for a little while, and then one day they had a position opening, and I sort of knew the ropes a little bit, and because I knew everyone,
yeah.
That's how I got in. Like, that's my, always my advice to people, is like, just get the job, and again, it's probably difficult now because a lot of these jobs are unpaid and stuff, but like, when I was working, so there's a guy, James Serafinowicz, who's like amazing writer. Mm-hmm. He got into writing because he was doing a running job. He always loved writing. He was doing a running job. He was running on Brass Eye with Chris Morris.
Brilliant.
And one day he just went to Chris like, I've just had an idea for a bit. And Chris went, all right, yeah, let me have a look at it. And then the next day Chris was like, do you want to come sit in the writer's room? That's how these things happen. They don't happen because...
Brave of him as well to go up to Chris Morris and say, I've got a really good idea, Chris.
Hey, I can see what you're trying to do here, but this... That's kind of it, and that's what I mean by like having a dad in the industry kind of early on. That was what it was, but you still had to make a good film.
Sure.
Like, you still had to be good at that thing, you know what I mean? The same way when I came into it and did gigs, I had to be, I wouldn't say I was good. I was not good at all. I've only recently just become good at stand-up.
In your own head. It doesn't mean other people don't find my thing good,
but now I'm at a point where I'm confident as myself as a stand-up. Where for years you might have a bit that you like doing, but now I go like, oh, I can walk on. I'm good enough to be. Meant to be here.
Yeah. Can I just, because one thing that I found really interesting that you talked about was feeling from the age of eight that was what you were going to do, but also that it was a something you could do. But I feel like as well as that, maybe that went unsaid a little bit is your dad obviously must, and your mum and dad must have been incredibly supportive towards. That being a possible career for you as well, because I could totally see it if it was someone else being like, don't do what I did, son, it's too much hassle, it's too much, you know, you're not guaranteed a living, you're not guaranteed this, but it must have been completely opposite to that.
Yeah, that's another thing that was a huge help. There's nothing sadder than when someone's parents don't like, you think of like, there'll be some amazing comedians, you know,
who are made to be doctors and lawyers and stuff.
Yeah, or like they'll do like an amazing show and you're just like, their parents, like you hear people, my parents come, they don't really get what I do. And they'll be doing like a 1,000-seat theatre. Their parents will be like, it's just, I don't get it.
Right,
and they're like,
right.
But yeah, my parents were very supportive. They probably wouldn't have been supportive if I was really shit.
Right.
Like if I'd went up there and just started, I remember this from my first gig. I was nervous, and my dad was taking me there. And on the way there, like, I'd told him a few routines I'd written, and there was this one about this teacher I had, and she'd always try to teach us about Cardinal Wolsey, and the routine was just taking a piss out of, like, she's always saying, my dad went, you should do that, and I went, I don't know, that's just not me, I don't know too much about it. And he went, no, you should do that. And I went there, and I just said, I'm not going to do that. No. And I didn't do it, and after the gig, my dad went, yeah, you were right, you shouldn't have done that. And he went, no, you were right, the stuff you did worked. And I remember just sort of from that point, it was a really nice lesson in my first gig of like, trust your gut in something. Like whenever someone goes, I don't know, maybe you
even in the face of a successful professional comedian telling you something opposite.
Yeah, because and the reason I know that sounds arrogant, but it's really true, is because it's not him up there as me.
No,
it's me.
Yeah,
I'm up there. My dad goes up there and can do his thing better than I could go up there and do the thing that my dad did. I can't do what my dad does in the sense of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that's not that's stuff not that I'm are. Interested in.
Yeah.
And I mean in terms of material. If my dad will go up there and do an amazing bit about Brexit and be able to rationalise it and be so knowledgeable about it, I can't. The only bit I can do on Brexit would be about my view of that. I couldn't give it. Can this just be, you know what I mean? I don't care. But my dad will know everything that's going on. Or he'll know exactly who each member of the shadow cabinet is and who the cabinet is, and his audience will know that. If I go up there and try and do that, it's going to look pathetic.
Of course it will. But equally, if he started talking about what it was like to be a 21-year-old now, it would be the same thing. Yeah. It would be absolutely the same. Did you have a good relationship in general with your dad growing up? Do you feel like the fact that he was a comedian made him kind of different to the other dads of your friends and stuff like
definitely.
That?
Definitely. He was definitely absent for a lot of things. It was weird. Sort of when I was about 15, I was sort of hanging out with the wrong crew because where I did go to school, it was quite rough. Mm-hmm. I always had a bit of sense on me. Like I played on the football team quite a bit, and it was the football team was just full of kids who were just rough as fuck, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was sort of pre-gentrification of South London when I went to school, just as it was starting to happen. Yeah. Like one school I went to, I left, and a week later, you can look it up, it was called Ashburton, it's now called Oasis Academy Shirley Park. They had a school riot that made the front page of the South London Press, like an actual riot at the school. And I'd left a week earlier, and I was kind of a bit like,
they really didn't want you to leave.
but I read it, I was kind of like, man, I missed the riot. Like, I
would have got a day off school.
Where he was away a lot, because my dad was a single parent who brought me up.
Oh, okay.
I didn't really see my mum much as a teenager.
Okay.
My mum's not famous, so we don't have to give a fuck about her on this podcast.
It doesn't sound like you want to give a fuck about her, to be honest.
My mum's a teacher. I think everything makes sense.
Okay. You've said as much as you want to and enough to give us the vision of how that worked out.
So I grew up, when I was sort of hanging about with the wrong crowd quite a bit because I wanted to be popular. Mm-hmm. They were really nice kids. They just came from like a, you know, single parent homes. They were felt like they had to fit into this South London bravado, and I was doing it as well. Except I had a bit more sense on me because I knew there was other things in life, and I don't think some of them did. I would hang around with my dad, so I wouldn't hang out with my dad. So my dad would be away on tour. And then I'll just be like, well, no one's at home or anything. I'm not going to go home. I'm just going to hang out with the kids after school. I think I've made that clear. I've said it about 8 times. And we'd go do stupid things, you know. Like, I remember this one time, I'll tell this story. We got in this fight with this kid who we shouldn't have got in a fight with because his brother was, like, the guy in the area. Mm. And I don't just mean, like, the hard... Like, I mean, like, South London guy in the area, you know what I mean? And my mate got in a fight with him. It was about 15 when this happened. Got in a fight with him. My mate smacked him up. About a year goes by. We think absolutely nothing of it. And a year's gone by and we're now very different people. Mm. I mean, a new sixth form, got new, but I'm still good mates with this guy who's smacked up this kid. Mm-hmm. We're very different people now. We're in sort of sixth form. We're a bit more out of the bravado. We're finding ourselves, like you said, we've gone to sixth form and our things now, chatting to girls and, you know, and we started like smoking weed at that point. So like it was more like, hey, let's meet up and hang out, smoke weed. We don't have to do any of this other stuff. And we're walking through Crystal Palace one day and this lad came over. And I'll say what his name is. He was called like Ramps in the area or something. And he went, oh, you boys have to come with me. I was like, oh, why? He's like, you know why? You smacked up my little cousin.
A year ago,
right? And like, he takes us and we're like, man, I don't. And he turns to my mate. He goes, yo, how old are you again? And my mate's like 16. He looked at me and I looked about 12 at the time. He went, how old are you? And I went, 12. Because I thought, and he's like, this guy's like 25. Takes us down his bit of the estate, calls up his cousin and goes like, yeah, I got a boy who smacked up, I'll say his name was Bullet. He come down. So this guy, J-Dot, who was the big guy in the area, came down and basically made me sit there and like just came down with these bats, just started hitting my mate. Like we kind of deserved it. But I was stood there, I was kind of watching it like, should I jump in? And it was at this moment I knew I wasn't hard because I looked at it and I went, nah, do you know what? They've got a point. Like, we shouldn't have done that. And luckily,
you'd
a police
have to be
car,
a very brave 12-year-old to jump in at that point.
Exactly. I was just stood there and I was like, what am I going to do? I'm going to jump in and then I'm just going to be hit with a... that's the point where, you know how, like, whenever you watch, like, a gangster film, or, like, you watch Goodfellas and you go into, like, Henry Hill, no, don't snitch. You were there at the same time. And that's when I found out I would be the guy in the group who snitched. I would be the first one that any sign of trouble. Yeah. Like, you know, Save It Private Ryan, when there's the knife fight going, there's that scene where these two guys are wrestling for the knife and one of the soldiers is there just in shell shock. He's just there crying. He doesn't want to be involved with it. I would be that soldier. That's who I would be in any of those situations. And that was, And I sort of went through that, and that's why I thought I was like quite tough and stuff. But that's because my dad wasn't like always around.
Yeah. Have you spoken to your dad since about this stuff and how you think it could have been dealt with differently?
I told him that story, and his view on it was like kind of like, yeah, well, you shouldn't have got in a fight. Because he grew up in Swanley, like he grew up in a really rough area. So my dad's got this kind of like working class, like, well, yeah, you
get what you deserve.
You shouldn't have got in a fight. That's what do you think's going to happen?
Yeah.
It was really, I know it might sound like really harsh, because everyone was fine. It was all cool. But it sounds like
just hit with bats. Don't worry about it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That happened. That would happen quite. I've got a few stories like that. We got one. There was one again. There was nearly this big fight in a pub. There was this pub that used to let me and my mates in when we were like 17. It's completely off topic now.
That's all right. Don't worry.
They'd let us drink in it when we were 17. But I had a mate who was like the cockiest kid in the world.
Right.
Like he was just full of bravado. And we're in this bar and we're allowed to drink. Like it's amazing, but it's quite an upmarket sort of bar. But it was in Crystal Palace, just as like so you'd get like different groups of people would come in.
Yeah.
Everyone would have their section. And my mate starts chatting up this girl, and me and my friends notice that her boyfriend's just gone to the toilet.
Yeah.
And she's sort of enjoying being chatted up by someone she perceives as like 18 or 19.
Mm.
And she's probably like 30 odd. So she's kind of had a few drinks. She's kind of enticing it, but it's going nowhere. And this guy comes back to from the toilet with his mate. So they clearly like just been doing cocaine.
Mm.
And he goes to my mate, like, what the fuck are you doing? And my mate doesn't go like, he hasn't been in enough bars to go like, sorry, dude.
Yeah.
Read the situation
realize,
wrong.
Yeah.
My bad, man. There's nothing to be aggro about. I apologize. My mate's like 17 and he's like, you know, like one of the biggest kids in school, but he's not a big kid in terms of the pub. And he's like, his immediate response, he went, who the fuck are you? The pub police, just making sure I can't talk to people, the pub Gestapo.
Jesus.
And like, it just nearly like kicked.
God.
And it's like that point, it was like, we went from being these sort of like cocky 17 year olds to seeing these guys' faces to being like, hey, Jay, man, I don't.
How quick were you out the door of that pub?
We went outside and we were kind of like, we were doing that thing of like, what? But we weren't going to do anything. Like,
yeah.
We were, because they were just like 30-year-old dudes who weren't going to fuck about.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. No, no one got hit in that story, actually, when I come to think
well,
of it.
Well, that's good. That is a good. I'm worried about you, Elliot. Just to go back on that thing, in terms of you feeling like your dad was absent at times,
yeah.
Obviously because of his work. How do you kind of mirror that up with the fact that he was a single parent bringing you up, so he needed to go out and work, and the fact that he wasn't there, and that must have been difficult as well?
I didn't ever have any, like, I've never had any resentment towards my dad for that, because like, I understand, like, one of the reasons like my dad's been able to support me a little bit through comedy is because he's built a life for himself. He's got a tour, and since doing comedy, I understand it even more.
Yeah.
That like, the thing is, when you work like a job at the levels that my dad works at, your career comes first a lot of time. And sometimes you can rationalize that as like, well, I'm earning this money and that supports the family. However, I might not be there a lot of the time. And then when you think about someone like, I mean, like how someone like McIntyre sees his family, God only knows, you know what
or
I mean?
Or Jimmy Carr. Seems to me like maybe Jimmy doesn't like his home life that much.
Does Jimmy have a family?
No, he has a partner, doesn't he? But he is just constantly on tour the whole time.
But I imagine she knew what she was getting into.
No, definitely, yeah.
I think that's also a thing of like
that
my dad's...
No, the relationship maybe works best like that. That, you know, long...
Was your dad about... Martin
no,
as a kid?
My mum and dad kind of split up before I even remember. So,
right, yeah.
But my stepdad, Angus, was. Yeah. And the reason why I'm doing this podcast is because of my relationship with both Angus, who was obviously famous, and then my mum and dad, who had previously had a bit of fame and stuff.
Right.
But so he was more like my father figure, and he's the reason why my whole family are musicians, but I'm into sport and comedy, because from when I was like 3 to 13, Angus was living with me.
Right, okay.
So I had a father figure, but it wasn't my dad. So, that you know, that makes my relationship with my dad actually kind of... I've always kind of described him as more like a cool older brother.
Right,
who talks about the music industry and, you know, loved a bit of coke and stuff.
Right, yeah, okay. Because the music industry is by far cooler than the comedy industry in terms of, like... I'm going to play music, and even if you're a low-level guy at pub with guitar who's been booked to do it, you will get more girls than professional stand-up comedian. It is by far... Stand-up comedy is one above mime.
Is that how... Is that how
like we... just above poetry. We're just a bit... There are probably poets out there who get more girls than, like, the most famous comedians.
I'm intrigued as to... Is that how we determine what cool is? By how many girls we get?
Cool is determined by the parties and, like in the music industry, if you turn up to a music party... I'm going to be like, well, people are going to be doing blow. There's going to be people getting... I'm imagining like a Motley Crue kind of like party. Mm. You turn up to a stand-up comedian party, there's going to be like one line of coke and everyone's just going to be talking about how someone doesn't book them and someone else is a cunt. That's a stand-up comedy party.
And they're sharing the line of coke.
Yeah. Or they're doing what I was doing. They're watching shit of stand-up comedians on YouTube. That's a stand-up comedy party.
Oh, that's... I've really got that vision. I will say I've been to a few music business parties, and it's the main difference between music industry parties and stand-up parties is music industry people really, really take themselves incredibly seriously.
Right.
Incredibly seriously. So, yeah, maybe the mountain of cocaine is slightly bigger, but my God, are they talking about how great they all are? And then the stand-up one is possibly a little bit more insecure and everyone's just like, why is this person doing better than I'm doing? And stuff like that. But I think the one line of coke is probably pretty...
And the stand-up party as well is like, if you make them... Like you sit down with like my mates or something, like stand-up comics are relentless, man. Like, if you even, like, dare, like, trip up the stairs, the next 30 minutes of your life, you're going to be made to be insecure about the way you walk upstairs. You didn't know you had to be insecure walking upstairs, but all of a sudden you now have a complex because they found you. The way I describe comedians is with my mates, right? Like, we were in a WhatsApp group. We're relentless for each other. Like, just relentless. But I really enjoy it. I think the one important thing, and it's sad to see it go in stand-up comedy, is bullying each other.
Right.
Like, you have to bully each other. And it's done with love. Because what bullying in comedy is like, we're going to do far worse to you in here than can ever be done to you on stage.
Yeah.
So when you're on stage and that guy's just shouting the basics, most like, your shit, whatever, or get whatever. Or
you've heard it all before.
Some lad Bible-ish recycled banter. It's like, okay, well, for example, like, there's... Daniel Sloss and Kai Humphries are back there, and my mate Ryan Cullen, who are just amazing at just... Ryan will just find something you do and just destroy you for it. It's like you're not gonna faze me, and it's done with love.
Yeah.
You're accepted. Don't worry, you're one of us. If you walk into a green room, and even if you don't know all the comics, and you go out and have a set, and they come back and they start giving you shit about something, you're one of us. You're cool, and that's what I think I really enjoy as the camaraderie in comedy, because it's also a thing of, like, we are deeply insecure. We are all of this, but this is something that no one else does to this level of, like, just berate you for this. And the way I describe comics is we're usually 99.9% of things, of jokes you can do about us, does not bother us. Even if it's supposed that, I imagine if someone wants to go for you and you're like, your dad, you talk about your dad being absent in your life, you can openly admit that on a podcast.
Sure.
So you're probably cool with it. But there'll be a 0.1% that the comic's looking for. And once they find it, it's like they've just found that little chink in your armor and it just sets you, and they go, there's the thing.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
So that's quite an alpha. It feels like quite a male-y thing. How in your experience of writers' rooms and hanging out with female comics, do you feel like they're similar or it's different?
Yeah, female comics is comics are comics. You know, it's very similar. I'd say the one thing you can't do, and this is definitely a male to female thing in general, don't go for a woman's looks.
Right.
Like, because you if we go down to it, you live in a society that is patriarchal where women are made to feel like everything. You look at adverts for women's look, it's just like, you need to look like this, you need to do this, every celebrity in your life is this. Whereas the male complex is like, you show me a pair of boxers modelled by Cristiano Ronaldo, I don't go, oh, he's got a better body than me. I go, man, maybe if I buy them, I could play for Real Madrid still.
Right,
like,
right,
I still
right.
think, like, that's how my male ego works.
Yeah. There must be some male comedians, though, who probably don't want to have the piss taken about how they look as well, though. I can think of a few.
Yeah. It depends
about their weight, particularly.
Yeah,
probably.
It depends on who it is. I don't mean like walk into a green room and just do that to anyone. You've got to have you've got to have your pals.
Yeah. Have you got examples of where people have treated you differently because of your dad's fame or success that you can think of?
Yeah. Other comedians have definitely been... I wouldn't say nicer. They've just been a bit more like, oh, I'm a fan of your dad's, and they'll, like, talk to me about it.
Okay. Never negatively.
Never negatively. Not, I can recall. If it would have happened negatively, they wouldn't have said because of who... I never got on with your dad. Actually... The only one I can think of is I'm a huge Jim Jefferies fan, and I got to meet Jim. I was really, really, really happy to meet Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And like he found out, and then he just told me a story. He was like, oh man, one time I met your dad and he was just a bit dismissive and it really hurt me. And I was like, oh my God. Like, and I was all of a sudden like there apologizing to Jim Jefferies. And then I told my dad about it. And my dad like was like, oh God, my dad felt really bad. And then I was like there with like my comedy hero, like having to apologize.
You became the mediator between your dad and Jim Jefferies.
That was one time. But I think, I think that happened because it might have been like my dad's thing is like, oh, I might have just been about to go on stage or something. That was like my dad's, because my dad's never really, I've never seen my dad be dismissive to people when they've come up to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think like, I don't know, I think it might have been one of those things where in Jim's head, he was dismissed, but in my dad's head, he was like, hey man, could I talk to you afterwards? I'm just about to go on. It was something like that.
Like me and Rob Beckett back in the day.
Yeah, it was just a thing.
You've talked quite a lot, I think, that I've seen on Twitter and maybe in some other podcasts and even here about your ADHD and mental health and stuff. Do you feel like growing up around fame and your dad being in the public eye has affected you in any way in terms of relationships, mental health, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's definitely made me very narcissistic.
Okay.
It's definitely made me... I'm having to unlearn what I've learned is that success isn't measured in fame or money. Success comes from sounds very wanky, a deeper place. You know, no matter how, if you told me several years ago I'd be where I am in comedy, I'd be like, wow, that's cool. And now I'm here, and I'm still thinking like I was a few years ago. I'm like, well, I need to get to here, I need to get to here, I need to do this. And that's, I think that's a very unhealthy attitude to have.
Mm.
And I saw that attitude growing up, which is why I have it, which is like, oh, you need to get to this. And I'm not in competition with my dad at all. Like, I've never, ever, I'm very odd in that way. Like, I'm quite good with that. That has definitely, you've got to become this, that, and the other to be a success. And is that a terrible attitude?
Is that awareness of that something you've unraveled through therapy or just through experience and time?
Just the last like 6-7 months, I've realized like, okay, nothing's ever going to be enough.
Yeah.
But that doesn't just come from my dad. That comes from like, I grew up I'm part of the generation on Instagram where everyone's got a private jet and this, that, and everyone. Everyone only shows the good bits of their lives now. So you're only seeing the good bits of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not seeing a bit where, you know, you see some singer go like, look, I'm got this car and that. You're not seeing them like, you know, have a horrible set in front of 8 people and they have to just sit there and buy. You know what it's like in comedy, man? Like the best bit of advice I ever heard was not advice that was given to me, and it was from Daniel Sloss.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw him play 1,200 people at the Archie Kentish Forum, and a couple of weeks later he was going around, he was just starting to do like 1,200 seaters and 1,000 seaters. And I saw him come off stage and he went up to Kai Humphries and he went, man, do you remember when we played to 8 people in Leeds?
Mm.
And that was like a big mindset change for me. Like, everyone has to do that.
To get there.
Everyone has to do that gig where you go, this is depressing.
Yeah. Like, in my experience, many, many of those gigs.
Yeah. But you will have like several hundred of those stories.
Yeah. I really look forward to my 1,200 seater gig where at the end I'm talking about the time I was thrown off stage by the MC underneath. Did you ever do that back in the day? There was a famous like underneath the Thistle Hotel at Leicester Square gig.
Oh my God!
It was booked by a guy who was putting out flyers.
Inky
with like,
Jones.
Yeah. The Inky Jones.
I never
gig,
did it. I always heard about that. The guy run a con gig where he'd be like. He would be like, Lee Evans is on.
Yeah, and so he'd fly a Leicester Square with a flyer with like Lee Evans, Michael McIntyre, all those on it.
Yeah.
And then the time I did it, you're taken downstairs under the Thistle Hotel to a kitchen, right?
Yeah.
Where the MC talks to you, and you're like 8 open micers, right? And he's like, here are the things you're not allowed to talk about. You're not allowed to talk about the cost of the tickets. You're not allowed to talk about the fact that everyone in the audience is foreign. You're not allowed to talk about the fact that you're not being paid, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like still a very raw comedian, let's put it that way. Rob would definitely describe me as just talking about disgusting stuff.
Right, yeah.
And it was just like red rag to a bull. And I was just like, well, that they're the things that I'm going to start talking about.
You're a comic, man.
Well, there you go.
That's what I mean. That's what I was trying to explain earlier, is like the minute you tell me...
What not to do.
Fuck you, I'm going to do it because it's funny. It's funnier then. For some, it makes it more exciting because there's an act of rebellion to it.
Yeah. Well, so then the MC dragged me off. And I never knew if the MC was Inky Jones or someone employed by Inky Jones, but he dragged me off and, you know... What a gig, though, for that for Inky Jones, because he was charging everyone 15 quid and they were all foreigners and didn't know what the fuck was going on.
He got done by HMRC.
Yeah, I saw on tour, so that was an enjoyable moment.
It kind of upsets me that I know what he did was bad for the industry, but I kind of just think like...
You like his chutzpah.
I just liked the fact that he was doing it, like that he was just out there. It's, like, you know some of those comedy promoters that are so brave, they just don't give a shit. I'm going to pretend that McIntyre is on here tonight and there's going to be 100 or so tourists who come in and we're going to do several shows and then I'm just going to put open spots on and then just tell them, he didn't turn up.
Yeah,
I kind of respect
you respect the brazenness of it. But at the time, certainly, it was above my pay grade and therefore I wasn't able to deal with it in the way I should have done. Or maybe I did
dealt with that exactly as you should have done.
What is the most unusual thing that has happened to you as a result of being Mark Steele's son?
Nothing. This is kind of like I've not had. I'm sure your other guests would have had a great story. My dad, when he was famous enough, he's not hugely famous anymore. Like he's famous to Radio 4.
That is going to cut deep.
But he's well known.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's not like. I've never got a story of like I've walked into Gucci and they've gone, this is Mark Steele's son. It's like low.
Have any dress you want, Elliot.
Yeah. Exactly. And like, it's never, I suppose it's like, nothing springs to mind.
So do you feel like he's kind of trod the line in your childhood of being on TV but never, you know, never up to a level where you'd say famous, more like very successful in his field.
Of his own choice. He didn't want to be a celebrity. My dad's got stories, funnily enough, about Richard Madeley, right?
He must have been offered a lot of things to make him a celebrity. Actually.
Yeah, he just never, ever, ever really wanted to be celebrity. He never wanted, like, red carpet, this, that. That isn't what he wants, which is kind of what you got to do when you're at his level of the thing. You've got to... You know, I'm at this red carpet event, then I'm at this party, then I'm at... You kind of got to do that. My dad's always just been like, I don't want to.
And is that something you'll be happier to do than your dad was, do you think? Let's say you get offered I'm a Celebrity, like Joel Dommett did.
No, I would never do I'm a Celebrity.
Why is that?
Because how... All right, fuck Joel, innit?
Hold on, how about this? I'm the producer of I'm a Celebrity, Elliot, and I've got a suitcase here and it's got £75,000 in it.
£75,000, but then how could I go? And this is easy to say in a theoretical situation. The better choice would be like it's an advert,
yeah,
or something. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'd be offered something like I'm a celebrity. I would like to think my agent would turn it down and never let me know he got it.
Okay, that's interesting.
Because I think how can I go on stage and talk about the things I want to talk about when you've seen me on I'm a Celebrity
chewing a bull's penis,
also the audience that would bring. So I did an audition for an ITV2 show voiceover, and I went in, I was doing it and I knew I wasn't going to get it because I sucked at it, and I was so glad I was sucking at it because I just knew I wasn't going to be offered it. And the reason for that is because I don't want some like ITV2 audience like turning up.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like if I want to go on and talk about certain things that are like heavier topics, if you've seen me on a show where I'm not doing that, that is then don't get me wrong, I mean like do primetime shows, do those kind of things. But I wouldn't, if I did that and then I had an audience turn up who were like, hey, he's going to do something about that. And then I've got like a 10-minute bit like I do in my show about like how internet porn has fucked up an entire generation of people and really go into it.
Yeah.
there might be a few people from that who do it, and I know a couple of people going, this is heavy from the guy who ate kangaroo bollocks.
Yeah. No, that's true. And do you know what? Dare I say it, and feel free to disagree, but that seems like it's got a bit of your dad in it. Like your dad's experience, education in you. An artist comedian rather than a
what we were talking
comedy
about
to be famous.
Of knowing yourself. That is part of it. Don't try to be something. I look awkward on those shows. Like, I've done auditions for things like that. I look awkward when I'm stood there and they have to be... I'm deeply cynical. I would like turning up and being like, this sucks. You know what I mean? Isn't this stupid? Like, there's a war in Syria.
I hope you do that in front of the series producer.
Yeah, there's a war in Syria at the moment. But yeah, cool. I'm going to stand here and... Why are you... Anyone who comes to this is stupid. But I'm more stupid for being on it. Like, I like coming from that angle.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't get you the part.
From my experience, that wouldn't make me give you the part either. That's really funny. Okay, and we end on one question always that we ask. If you could live your life all over again, but without having had a famous father, would you swap?
Only if I could go with someone more famous.
Yeah, go on.
Like someone like George Clooney or someone, someone that's like people, someone that will get me something from being famous. This is the most I've had out of my dad's fame, is this podcast. This is it.
I'm so pleased. I'm so pleased that we've finally given you what you want.
This is my walk into Gucci and take what you want, sir.
Listen, Elliot, no offense to your dad, but I'd rather you'd be George Clooney's son as well. Don't tell him. Elliot, is there anything you'd like to plug that's coming up, or your Instagram, Twitter account?
Follow me on Instagram, I'm at Elliot Steele, and on Twitter at ElliotSteele.com. I'll be posting all my gigs when I've got my solo dates and stuff that I'm just sorting out at the moment that I'd love people to come to.
Brilliant.
And see my stuff. My dad's not going to be there, so don't even ask. Go fuck yourselves. But thank you so much for having me.
No, mate, thank you so much for coming on. Can I also say to the listeners, thank you so much for listening. Press the subscribe button. Follow us on Insta, Almost Famous, the podcast, and on Twitter, Pod Almost Famous. And make sure you tune in for our next episode. Thanks once again, Elliot, and goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.